This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Robin Dow producing, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Joey Strickland's our leadoff guest. If you'd like to talk with him, 877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org for emails. He's the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs and has an amazing backstory, and sometimes I might overuse that word, but in this case, it is appropriate. He has a background like few, if any, other people. He's a Choctaw Cherokee member. His mother, I think, was
Choctaw.
Full-blood Choctaw. And in 1966, when he graduated from Tallulah High School, where he played for the Tallulah Trojans, he was a fullback, and they had a halfback on the same team named James David Buddy Caldwell.
Right.
Now, Buddy Caldwell says he ran a 9.200. I think he might be fudging.
He wasn't quite that fast.
But he was fast. He was a good player, I understand. And you were a good player, and in the same backfield. That's an amazing story in the hamlet of Tallulah, Louisiana.
Yes, sir.
I'm familiar with because I go Highway 65 to Little Rock, and I go through Tallulah and Lake Providence. I know all those towns, Newellton. Been through there many, many times, and Buddy Caldwell still lives there after all these years.
I just spoke with Buddy about 2 weeks ago. He's had a little bit of health issues, but he's doing fine.
But when you graduated from Tallulah High School, you didn't go to college. You could have. Ultimately, you did, but you went in the U.S. Army in the middle of a war, and we're talking 1966 when it was treacherous. What happened?
Well, Jim, I come from a family of military veterans, and so I just felt like it wasn't my time yet to go to college, and I needed my dad was an old farmer, and he said you either get a job or go to college. So I said I'll get a job in the United States Army. So I did. But being young and naive and adventurous, I went infantry. I joined the airborne, and which is probably not something that most people would do, but I did. And I got assigned to the 82nd Airborne Division in Fort Bragg for about a year, a little over a year. And then one day I got orders to ship out to the 1st Air Cavalry Division in Vietnam.
So you had a one-year tour of duty, and then what happens?
Well, then I came back after that tour, and it was a tough tour because in January of 1968, we got hit with the Tet Offense, where combat was just about in every city and town all over Vietnam. As a matter of fact, we were concerned that we were going to lose that whole situation until we were able to get a handle on it and turn it. We even had combat in the U.S. Embassy. And so I was a door gunner on a Huey helicopter, and we were flying air support, close air support for ground operations. We were flying just about every day in combat. And so it was a tough tour of duty, but I made it through, thankfully, came back, went to Fort Eustis, Virginia for a helicopter maintenance school, and then I got promoted to staff sergeant and went right back to Vietnam for a second tour in 1970.
So you had 2 1-year tours in lovely Vietnam.
Yes, sir. It wasn't so lovely then, but I understand that has changed.
Well, I know you have been honored for 7 combat ventures. And when we say combat, we're talking about hand-to-hand combat in some cases and people getting killed. How did you survive?
Well, I don't know, Jim. I think I've often thought about that. I think you can only attribute to what God has in store for you, because there were days when we would lose helicopters with 4, 5, 6 of our crew members on board. And they were gone. They were there one day, and the next day they were gone. They were dead, shot down, or crashed. Mm-hmm. We were constantly being mortared and rocketed in our fire support bases, and not just small mortar rounds. These are 122 millimeter rockets, big ones that would make a 6-foot hole in the ground. Mm-hmm. And we would lose soldiers by ones and twos, even in the fire support bases. So I only attribute it to God.
Joey Strickland ultimately rose to the rank of captain,
colonel.
And then colonel, a major, captain, major, colonel, retired after 28.9 years. He's really specific on this, and he is now the Veterans Affairs Secretary. Was director of the Arizona Department of Veterans Services too.
Right, I was. I was first appointed director of Veterans Affairs in Louisiana by Mike Foster, who was a really close friend of mine. He had grown up with the Chitimacha Indian tribe, and when he found out that I was Choctaw, we became close friends. I was director of Indian Affairs for the state in those days, and he told me that he was going to run for governor, and if he was elected, he would appoint me Secretary of Veterans Affairs, which was what I really wanted in life. That's all I wanted to do, is to help my fellow mm-hmm. veterans. And he was true to his word. He had been a veteran and had fought in Korea during the Korean War. A lot of people don't know that. He flew cargo planes in Korea. So he had a love for veterans. He didn't broadcast mm-hmm. it too much, but the Department of Veterans Affairs was in trouble back in those days, Jim. We had one veterans home. We were authorized five. We had no state veteran cemeteries. So I told the governor, I said, we're in trouble. I said, we're not supporting our veterans the way that we should.
Yeah.
He said, do what you got to do, Joey, and I'll support it. And so we started building veterans homes. I supervised the building of four of them, and we started building state veteran cemeteries. The oldest one is in Keithville up near Bossier, Barksdale Air Force Base. It's 12 years old.
Well, and Joey Strickland, a few years ago, was president of the National Association of State Directors of Veterans Affairs. He loves his job, and he loves the people who served our country and did so in an unpopular war. And as we know, when you look at the people at highest levels of our government, and Secretary Strickland and I have talked about this, most of them found a way to avoid service. When he was 18, he said, I'm all in, and ended up getting not one but two 1-year tours of duty in Vietnam, and is fortunate to be here to talk with us. And he's doing so today's playing hurt. He's just had rotator cuff surgery, but he's a tough guy, and a lot of other tough people will be saluted appropriately for their service in Vietnam right here in our midst. What's going to happen?
Well, the governor approached me last year, Jim, and he said, Joey, he said, I know that we've honored our Vietnam veterans every year. As a matter of fact, he was a speaker a couple of years ago, but he said, we need to do a statewide Vietnam recognition ceremony. And this is what this is. We're honoring the 50th commemoration of the Vietnam War, Jim, and we're bringing in as many Vietnam veterans into the Cane River Center on the 29th at 10 o'clock.
The 29th of this month?
Yes, sir, at 10 o'clock. And we're going to have a huge ceremony. Mayor Broome is involved. The governor's going to be the keynote speaker. We're working with
next Wednesday.
Yes, sir. We're working with the Vietnam Veterans State Commander and all the veterans. So we're excited. We've got a band that's going to be playing 60s music. Like, we got to get out of this place.
Yeah, I think that's Rob Payer.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Very good.
So we're going to have 60s music going on. We're going to have a huge movie screen showing Vietnam mm-hmm. battle scenes. LSU's involved. We're going to have weapons displays of that era.
Right.
And we're going to have a sit-down luncheon. And we have a special commemorative coin that mm-hmm. we're going to honor every veteran that attends with that coin. And then for the rest of the year, those that could make it, we'll be sending out those coins to them.
So that's 10 o'clock the 29th, 10 a.m.
Yes, sir.
And it's at the River Center.
Yes, sir.
So if somebody wants to attend, what do they need to do?
They just need to, it's on our web. All they need to do is RSVP and that they're coming. And that's it. We'll be waiting.
So just go to the Secretary or the Department of Veterans Affairs website, and you can get in the door.
Get in the door, and I'll have.
And
we'll
the
have
more
people,
the merrier.
The more the merrier. We'll have people as escorts. We've got it well organized. We're excited. This is It's going to be one of the biggest veterans events in the history of our state.
Wonderful. And Rob Payer, he probably do the song you mentioned. I wonder if he'll do Barry McGuire's Eve of Destruction. You remember that one, don't you?
Well, he's going to do that. I think he's going to do some Creedence Clearwater, Run Through the Jungle.
Yeah, Fortunate Son.
Fortunate Son.
I ain't no senator's son. Patricia in Magnolia Woods, you're on with Secretary Strickland. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I'd like to thank you for your service, and I know that's a more common phrase today than it was back in the early 1970s. But my question is, do you feel like we are supporting veterans and thanking them enough? You hear about homeless veterans and problems with the VA. Thanks.
I do, and one of the concerns and one of the programs that we adopted about 8 years ago is in support not only of homeless veterans, because no veteran deserves to be homeless, and we are working with Volunteers of America and other organizations to get them off the streets. But we're also, Louisiana has 33,000 women veterans. My daughter is a woman veteran. She's stationed at Carville with the Guard, and we're concerned about Louisiana's women veterans as well. So to answer your question, yes, we are supporting.
We're going to take a short pause and we'll return, spend a few more minutes with Joey Strickland. We've got a few more people in line to talk with him. And if you'd like to get in under the wire, 877-217-5757. And then it's journalist Emily Ramshaw right after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. On deck is Emily Ramshaw, who will be at the Manship School later today, and will spend a few minutes with us today to talk about her world as a top journalist in the nonprofit sector. But a few more minutes with Joey Strickland, Secretary of Veterans Affairs for Louisiana, and a big event a week from yesterday, March 29th, 10 a.m. River Center. And all you have to do is show up, but they do encourage you to go to the Department of Veterans Affairs website to RSVP, and it will be a gathering of thousands of people, many of whom served in Vietnam. And I remember in the day when World War II veterans were still hale and hearty, and now few are alive. And as we get older, the people who served in Vietnam, with that war now 50 years removed from its heyday, Richard Nixon pulled the plug in the latter stages of his presidency, but the early 70s. But these people now are all in their 70s, it would seem, who served there. And many, of course, were killed there, unfortunately, and others have felt the effects and have had health issues related to it. And I remember my dear friend Errol Savoy, 40 years after he came back, he died from exposure to Agent Orange. It just hit him all at once. Yes. And that's something you experience, and it makes me appreciative of his service.
It's 3 million Americans served in Vietnam, Jim, and 58,000 died or on the wall. 300,000 were wounded, including several sets of fathers and sons. And so today, now that our World War II generation is about gone, the biggest cohorts of veterans in America is the Vietnam crowd, and followed by the Iraq-Afghanistan, which today, those young men and women. Two of my sons served in Iraq and Afghanistan, but those young men and women, this will be their 20th year that war started.
So you had two sons who served and a daughter as well?
I did. I have three sons and all served, but one served in Iraq.
All of your kids?
All my kids, and my whole family's military.
All right. Isaac and Sherwood, we'll slide you in before we part company, and hopefully we'll have Secretary Strickland back soon. He is a remarkable individual with what a backstory. Isaac, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. You're a wonderful man, man. I've been listening to you for a long time. I'm 81 years old. I went in the Navy 3 days after Kennedy got killed. And I want to tell you, I want to say something good about the veteran. They take care of me.
COVID was a tough time.
It was a tough time, and we unfortunately lost a lot of wonderful veterans in our homes. We were able to get it under control now and are doing very well, but I'm always honored when I hear veterans. Number one, I get very few complaints from Louisiana veterans because we are working really hard to make sure that they're taken care of in terms of not only health care but compensation and pension benefits, Jim.
Final caller for Secretary Strickland, Randy and Zachary. Hello, Randy.
Yes, I just want to make mention there that they've always rightfully so talk a great deal of Vietnam War and World War II, but Korea seems to be skipped over for some reason. I don't know why.
All right. Well, that was another one. It didn't last as long as Vietnam. I mean, that may be it, but 50,000 Americans died in that one too.
That's a good question. I can address that. Since I've been the secretary, I've made it an annual event where we honor Korean War veterans. They are known as the Forgotten War veterans, but they are not forgotten by the Department of Louisiana Veterans Affairs.
And that was another one where at one point it looked like the U.S. was going to get ultimate victory, and then at other points ultimate defeat, and it ended up being a stalemate, but it was a bitter, bloody fight to the end.
It was one of the toughest wars that America has ever fought, and unfortunately, coming right at the end of World War II, it didn't get the publicity that other conflicts get.
And many of the World War II guys, like my father, who I think he would acknowledge he was past his prime, he sent back over to Korea, and that's tough when you've survived World War II to go back and have to do it all over again.
A lot of those Korean War veterans were World War II veterans, veterans of two wars.
Two wars, and some three.
Some three, yes.
There's a guy, my father's buried at National Cemetery in Little Rock, and near him is a fellow named, I've never met the man, but I just look at his tombstone, and I say a prayer for him when I walk by it, but he served in Roland Lee McDaniel. He served in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Silver Star, POW, and he was a real deal.
Greatest Generation.
I know his birth date, July 29th, 1928, which means he got in right. I mean, he probably had to lie to get to into World War II, as many did.
A lot of those guys did. They actually left the 11th grade to go serve, and then a few years ago, when I came back as Director of Veterans Affairs, I instituted a program to give a lot of those World War II veterans their high school diploma.
Well, thank you for your service. God bless you. And next Wednesday, if ever there were a group of people who should be celebrated and saluted, it's the Vietnam veterans who are still with us, and they'll all be in the River Center, March 29th, Wednesday, 10 a.m., and Secretary Strickland will be large and in charge. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
And we're joined now by Emily Ramshaw, who's a remarkable young journalist. She was the editor-in-chief of the Texas Tribune from 2010 to 2016, and she did some amazing stories there, and she is now involved in the world of nonprofit journalism and will be speaking this afternoon at the Manship School of Mass Communication, and the topic is experience building an independent nonprofit newsroom. And as we know, there are fewer journalists now, and the corporate entities, like every other corporate entity, are looking for ways to pay the bills and keep the doors rolling and the newscast going and the stories emanating. But it's a deal in which we're trying to find new ways to do journalism, and you're right there at the forefront. Emily, tell us about how this works with nonprofit journalists trying to do their job in a different kind of setting than what would be considered traditional.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for having me. And also, it's just been such a pleasure to be in Baton Rouge and to get to speak at the Riley Center for Media and Public Affairs. So, you know, I think what's fascinating about media in this environment is that you have this sort of whole generation of journalists, young journalists, who have come up in this business, you know, watching layoffs nonstop, watching business models that are failing, and trying to think about, you know, is there a path forward for us in media? And so I think you're seeing a lot of us, you know, journalists new and old, jumping into a nonprofit space that in many ways public media kind of, you know, public radio kind of set the model for, which is, you know, can we convince the public to support this philanthropically? Can we convince them to support us from a small dollar membership, a sort of viewers like me model, in a way that makes business models robust and sustainable? So my organization, the 19th, or organizations like the Texas Tribune or ProPublica, you know, we're trying to reinvent the ways that people think about journalism as a public good and worth opening their pocketbooks to support.
Emily's co-founder and the CEO of the 19th News, the nation's first independent nonprofit newsroom at the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. She'll be speaking a bit more than what we will hear from her today at 4 p.m. It's the Riley Center, but the event is at the Holiday Forum at the Old Journalism Building, 144 Fieldhouse Drive, right there next door to Tiger Stadium. So Emily Ramshaw will be there. But there are challenges for everybody in journalism now. What are the challenges you have with a nonprofit model?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously it's a hustle to fundraise. So a lot of my job really is going around the country and convincing people who believe that journalism is critical to our democracy, that the 19th is worth supporting. I seek out folks who are, you know, are really in the sort of women's rights space or the democracy reform space, and try to make the case that journalism is pivotal to our democracy and that if we don't have sustainable media and sustainable journalism, then we're in jeopardy as a nation. And so I think the fundraising is the big hustle, but then also the storylines are enormously significant right now. You know, obviously for so many women, the overturning of Roe v. Wade has been a really seismic event. It's changed how we think about reproductive health, reproductive rights. So much of what we see is going on in state.
Okay, we do have to take a short pause, but we will return for a few more minutes with Emily Ramshaw after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Mark Ballard is on deck, the intrepid reporter now in the Beltway, who logged a career of note as he spent a generation covering Louisiana politics in Baton Rouge, but now he's doing that and more in Washington, D.C. But we're wrapping it up with Emily Ramshaw, who's an innovative reporter, and that is basically her title, Innovative Media Entrepreneur. She's the CEO of a nonprofit news organization that is doing well, and as she just stated, everybody in the business now is trying to find new ways to cover the news, and you got to pay the bills. This is the 19th news. She'll be speaking 4 o'clock at the Manship School this afternoon, right next door to Tiger Stadium, and it is open to the public if you would like to attend. But one of your big passions is equality and covering news that is in a fair way for everybody, regardless of our gender or anything else. But is that easier said than done, Emily?
Oh, sure. Obviously, it is. I mean, I think, you know, this industry for a long time, media has been, you know, no offense to anyone, white or male, media has been very white and very male for a long time. And I think so organizations like ours are really trying to inject new voices, new representative voices into that journalism. But it's an uphill battle. And I just want to let you know, Jim, that, you know, the speaking engagement at the Riley Center was actually yesterday at 4 o'clock. But
oh, my goodness. I'm mistaken. I am so sorry.
No, it's great, but you can watch the entire video at lsurileycenter.com. Wow. It was live streamed, so the great news is you can tune in from wherever you are.
So you've already done it, and I appreciate the correction, because we would have had people going to the Riley Center saying, what's going on? But it is available online, and I'm sure Emily was a hit, and we commend the Riley Center. And I know there are people who donate, including the Riley family, to make these kinds of events go on, and thank God for that. Barry in Mid-City. Barry, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. I enjoy reading The Advocate, The Washington Post, The Wall Street Journal online, and I'm asking Emily, I'm worried about news because people catch it on Facebook and other places. And I'm worried for regular journalism, if you will, and people not reading newspapers.
Boy, I hear you. And yes, I think this is a huge problem. And, you know, what we know about people consuming their news on Facebook or on social media is that they're in an echo chamber and they really don't hear, you know, opinions that they don't agree with. You know, it's not great for how we think about sort of intellectual or ideological diversity. And so a lot of people still do trust their local media, which is why it's important that I think the nonprofit model is trying to reinvent journalism, not just nationally, but at the local level, too. And you're seeing that in communities across the country.
Well, Emily, thank you. And it's the old axiom, better late than never. I'm sorry we didn't get you before the event. I'm sure many people would have been interested in hearing you after listening to you on our show. But keep up your good work. And I know you've been involved in some really innovative stories, including a story that gained a lot of attention about a West Texas polygamous compound. How in the world did you find that story? How did you unearth that?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, there was a big raid. This was in Texas, and there was a big raid on the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It was a sort of offshoot of Warren Jeffs's. I'm sure you remember Warren Jeffs.
Yeah.
And so that was quite an experience, one of those stories where you run out to West Texas with the clothes on your back, and I ended up there for almost 3 weeks. So it was quite a story. Thanks for reminding me of that one.
And a listener who is somewhat familiar with your background and may have actually heard you yesterday notes that you did spend 6 years at the Dallas Morning News. So you have you've traversed the terrain as far as for-profit and nonprofit journalism. What's the major distinction, if any?
The major distinction, honestly, is the stability. You know, as a young journalist in my first 7 years at the Dallas Morning News, I think there were 5 or 6 different rounds of layoffs. You know, that's a frightening and destabilizing thing for a young journalist, for any journalist. So I think the biggest difference for me, whether it's at the Texas Tribune, a nonprofit newsroom, or now at the 19th, is that kind of sustainability and predictability. It turns out that philanthropy is actually quite sustainable.
Well, we thank you so much for joining us. Congrats, and let's keep in touch. Emily Ramshaw, appreciate you.
Thank you, and thanks to your great questioners.
And Mark Ballard is with us from The Advocate, who's in the Beltway, and we are 29 weeks and 2 days away from the October 14th primary for governor. And Mark Ballard, we miss you in Baton Rouge. And we were talking about journalism and how it's changing. And now it's hard to get a print copy of a newspaper sometimes, even The Advocate. If it doesn't come to my front step, sometimes I don't get it at all for a day. And Mark, I think you, like me, we lived a few blocks away for several years. You used to get the New York Times at your home, right?
Oh, yeah. And the Times-Picayune when they delivered.
You know, the New York Times is no longer delivering into homes in Baton Rouge.
Oh, no, I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah. So I have to go to an Albertsons to get my New York Times. And, you know, it's a little hard to go to Albertsons and then go to Louis, but.
You can sign up for getting it online.
I know. It's just not the same, though.
It isn't the same, but sometimes you have to, take a couple of breaks.
Yeah. But, so I have to go out of my way to get my New York Times and go to Louis and then drive to work. But, we all have our challenges in life. But speaking of Louis, today, Jimmy Weatherford, the boss, was in, and they were madly preparing breakfast. And I wondered, I thought, my goodness, why are they doing it for so many people in a restaurant that, doesn't seat but 50 or 60 people? But here it is. He gave me the email from the LSU football operation. 115 meals requested for the LSU football team. 43 egg scrambled bacon and pancakes. 43 egg scrambled bacon and French toast. 20 eggs, bacon, cheese bagel with potatoes on the side. 25 three egg scrambled chicken sausage, grits, and cheese. That's from the Brian Kelly and his football staff. 115 meals from Louis this morning. So the football team will be living large today. I'm sure they're feeling good right now.
I prefer Louis, but I thought LSU had its own cook staff.
They do. They do. But sometimes you gotta take it up a notch.
Right.
And so they ordered 115 meals from Louis this morning, and I'm sure Jimmy Weatherford was appreciative of the business. And thank God they know Louis is a place where you can get a good meal. And Brian Kelly, that was one of his first rites of passage in Baton Rouge, was to come to Louis for breakfast. So there you go. Well, you are spending a lot of time in Washington, D.C., where they have a lot of good restaurants, and it's a great city. 60% of the people have a college degree. But some of the people on Capitol Hill, we wonder about sometimes. And Mark, our delegation, as we've noted, is mute on some things and quite vocal on others. And it's going to be fascinating to see how the delegation, since nobody from the delegation is running for governor, gets involved in the Louisiana governor's race this year. Do you think they will be active participants?
I think they will, because, they are major league politicians, and it's hard for politicians to stay out of this. So, and also I think that the entrance of Mr. Wagasteck kind of adds a new dimension among the Republicans, and which will have them, the politicians, not taking sides publicly, but taking sides behind the scenes.
Well, Clay Higgins and Mike Johnson have already endorsed Jeff Landry, and now we have the others who we'll see what they do, but I would imagine Garrett Graves will endorse Stephen Waguespack. And yesterday, the governor of Louisiana was greeted with a bill that's been pre-filed by Representative Marino, who is retiring, to increase legislative pay in Louisiana from $16,800 base to $60,000 base, $60,000. Now, I don't know if this is going to be palatable in an election year, but Governor Edwards has been in favor of legislative pay going up, but should it go up that much? And will he bargain, Mark? He's got an opportunity now to say, look, people on minimum wage make $15,080 a year in Louisiana. That's still less than what you make, and you get per diem and travel. So will there be some horse trading going on that front?
You know, I think if they're going to get a raise, this will be the time that it happens, because they're going into the an election, you know, and so any raise will be for the next legislature. And you have a governor who is leaving office and is not going to be under the gun the way that Bobby Jindal was when he flipped on his promise for a raise back in whenever it was.
2008.
And so I think that it's going to happen. It's going to happen in this session. And the thing is that the pay for legislators has not gone up since the 1980s. And so I think that, you know, there is a firm argument for let's pay them and stop all of these kind of side per diem type of things that can run up the cost. And I think that'll be the argument.
Well, a listener asks about other states, and I know in Arkansas, legislators get paid $45,000 a year. Here it's $16,008, but there are some other additions, as we know. And if you have a position like Speaker or President of the Senate, you get more. But there is largely Louisiana underpays its legislators compared to other states. But in Arkansas, so they have an $11 minimum wage. We've got a $7.25 minimum wage in Louisiana. So I still think the governor, who's made this a major focus of his 8 years and has been unsuccessful, largely through the work from Stephen Waguespack to keep the minimum wage at $7.25. He has an opportunity to say, look, we'll go for an increase in pay for lawmakers, but we got to also have an increase in hourly wages for the people who are out there working 40 hours a week and making $15,080 a year for a 40-hour-a-week job. So we'll see what happens. And we got some folks waiting in line to talk with Mark Ballard, as always, on a Thursday. Still time to get in with him, 877-217-5757. We're back with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and the outstanding Robin Dow producing. Let's go to John on Perkins. John, you're on the air with Mark Ballard of The Advocate. Hello, John.
Hey, good morning. So regarding state politicians in Louisiana possibly getting what I would consider a pretty massive pay raise, how does that compare to the work that's being done to get educators a less substantial pay raise?
Yeah, it's lawmakers would be paid more than teachers if they get the whole $60,000. What do you think,
and Mark? That is a good argument for giving the teachers a pay raise. They should have it. They should be brought up to the Southern regional average. I don't think too many people would argue against that. On the legislators' behalf, not that I'm going to be arguing for legislators, they have not gotten a pay raise since the 80s, yet they get called into, I remember year before last, that they basically spent the first 8 months of the year in session and coming back for special sessions and that sort of thing. They're doing an important job as well.
877-217-5757. Thank you, John, on Perkins. Let's go to Patrick in Nisswa Estates. Hello, Patrick.
Hey, so I got a question on the national level. The Silicon Valley Bank bailout, and it's definitely a bailout. This is not a regulatory issue like the 2008, you know, where they...
But these are fees, though, that will take care of the shortfall.
Look, I'm okay with the up to $250,000, the FDIC, but people that put in over $250,000, I guess let me get to the point of my question, and that is, do you think that this bank would... We saw this with Bernie Madoff versus the Stanford people here in Texas. It seems like people that are leftists or like Silicon Valley, a lot of these Hollywood elites had their way more money than $250,000 in this bank. They get a bailout.
All right. I don't know if we'd call that a bailout, but at any rate, their investment is being protected. And it's being done so with fees, not taxpayer money. Now, the last one during the Bush administration, the bailout was from taxpayers, and that was George Bush in the final year, in his eighth year as president, when he oversaw a massive collapse of the financial industry. Mark Ballard, I gather Patrick doesn't think that anything above $250,000 should be protected.
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't quite follow what that argument was, but you're right. There were fees that are paid by the bank, and that is what that is rather than taxpayer dollars, and that's what's being used to bail out the Silicon Valley Bank, the bank in New York,
Carol
and some of the others.
Okay, I'm sorry, Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Yeah. Hi, Carol, you're on. Good morning.
I think you'd be hard pressed to find a liberal with any deposits in that bank.
Some liberals have money, believe it or not, but I'm amused that Patrick equates Silicon Valley with Hollywood. Silicon Valley is a long ways from Hollywood. That's like saying Little Rock and Baton Rouge are next door. So anyway, did you have a question, Carol?
I just wanted to let them know that I found offensive when I state a fact. It's not being objective. Last time I called, and it just seems like we don't write anything in the paper unless Wagaspat approves it. Thank you.
I don't know what he's getting at there.
I don't know, but again, come to objective is... nobody is objective. You're not objective. I'm not objective. He's not objective. The best you can do is be fair. Mm-hmm.
Well, the advocate, I'm sure, will be accused of taking sides in the governor's election. And Stephen Wagasbeck just got in. Obviously, his campaign has to be covered, and he is a significant candidate. I don't know. Oh. I still think that Jeff Landry is the favorite, but it would be imprudent for the advocate not to cover Mr. Wagasbeck's campaign.
I totally agree with you, because he's going to be a major candidate, and he has had a pretty major impact on the way government rolls. And the advocate and Times-Picayune, of which I have no input in, could pretty much decide who they want to back, because, you know, we live in America. And you have a right to your own opinion on these sort of things. And I point out that Mr. Wagasbeck has spent many a night cussing me out. So, you know, I like him okay, but, you know, to say that we're bros, I don't think is correct. Or
well, James in Metairie. Hello, James.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Mark. Mark, as the so-called imminent indictment and arrest of Donald Trump, the criminal, I think, there's a lawyer for a bunch of January 6th defendants who are now comparing Trump's arrest during Lent and comparing Trump to Jesus' persecution and ultimate resurrection. Have you been seeing any increased security measures being taken around the Capitol as we approach Trump's arrest?
There is, the Capitol has got a lot of security around it. I mean, far, far greater than anything that we see in D.C. I have a friend coming up on the weekend, but I cannot take her into the Capitol on the weekend because you need to have a pass, and they don't give them out on the weekends. I mean, we're seeing a lot more security around that. I'm not sure that it has to do specifically with Trump and his call for more rallying. I think that you see that in other cities. At least that's what I've been hearing about. But I don't think that there's going to be another attack on January 6th on the Capitol these days.
877-217-5757 in our remaining moments with Mark Ballard of The Advocate, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hello, Phil.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Mark. I'm wondering if the Supreme Court is going to do now. I mean, they stepped in and selected George Bush 20 years ago as our president, and boy, he had a wonderful presidency. And now, 20 years on, when Obama was elected, what was the headline? Worst job in the world goes to black man.
All right. I don't know exactly where Phil's going either, but all this conjecture about the Supreme Court, we'll see, but I think they made a terrible decision in stopping that recount in Florida in 2000, by one vote, by the way, 5-4. But the Supreme Court is composed of people right now, largely with a conservative bent. The nation is not as conservative as the court. And Mark, I do think people like Phil and others, including maybe yours truly, have concerns about the court being not reflective of society as a whole. But the way things are, it seems that's just the way it's going to be for a while, and you got to work with what you have.
Yes, that's true. But again, you got to say that even if you don't agree with their views, they have a right for those views. And I think that the court, more so than like Congress, has to be more reflective of what the legal theories and the theories on the Constitution has to be, and have a much broader perspective, which would allow for, you know, theories that you may consider crazy or that I may consider crazy. But I think that it's from that, it's from all of that, that we come up with an agreement on what the law ought to be.
Michael on Segan, please be concise. Michael, you're on with Mark.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to get Mark's perspective. You know, we're hearing everything about the governor's race, obviously, for good reason. But I'm also curious what he sees happening with the legislative races. And theoretically, if Landry was to win the governorship, how do you think our legislature might respond to that?
Well, he'll have a Republican majority, maybe a supermajority, Mark, but will Jeff Landry have an easier time working with the legislature than John Bel Edwards?
I think a lot easier time dealing with it. The way that the legislative seats were drawn last year, I mean, it's all kind of rounding together, but the way they are drawn for the next election will basically increase the number of ultra-conservative lawmakers in the Louisiana legislature, which I believe is going to be of great help for Mr. Landry. The question is, you know, will Mr. Landry be able to use that legislature to get an agenda progressed?
All right, David in Atlanta, our final caller. David, you're on with Mark.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Ballot, Congressman Jim Jordan, Comer, and McCarthy have threatened to take away any federal funds from the Manhattan Prosecutor's Office. This is a harassment effort to protect possible criminal charges against Donald Trump. Could this be construed as obstruction of justice?
What do you think? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not. Well, I'm not sure if it's an obstruction of justice, but the basic Republican argument has been that this is a political prosecution because we're talking about a crime that would not send him to prison, or if it would, it'd be for a minimal amount of time. So, you know, it's part of the narrative that they're talking about.
And by the way, the rally at the Capitol for Trump, led by Woody Jenkins and GOP Chair Louis Gurvich, it drew 24 people. So at this point, people aren't as juiced up about this as you might think. Thanks for joining us today. Back tomorrow. Thanks to Mark. See you soon.